now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. It was the mid-century murder that fascinated a nation and kept it glued for 2 years to radio, television, and newspapers through three trials. Did the handsome, wealthy doctor and his beautiful young paramour plan to kill his glamorous socialite wife? Or did the gun accidentally discharge, as he claimed? Early in the evening on July 18, 1959, Dr. Bernard Finch and his girlfriend Carol Ann Tregoff drove from their Las Vegas love nest to the Finch home in the Los Angeles suburb of West Covina to speak to his wife Barbara about obtaining a speedy divorce in Nevada. But the plan went awry, and the conversation turned deadly, with Barbara's lifeless body ending up in her in-law's backyard next door. After a high-speed chase with police, Finch was arrested the next morning in Las Vegas and charged with Barbara's murder. Then, during his court hearing in West Covina, Carol was arrested on the witness stand and charged as his accomplice. Soon others were named as part of a larger conspiracy. But who were they, and what parts did they play in these deadly events? Set against the mid-century cinemascope glamour of Hollywood, Las Vegas, and Palm Springs, Satin Pumps, the moonlit murder that mesmerized the nation, is a true crime memoir written by former Finch patient, screenwriter, and author Steve Kozarev. The book that we're featuring this evening is Satin Pumps, The Moonlit Murders That Mesmerized the Nation, with my special guest, screenwriter and author Steve Kozarev. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Steve Kozarev.
Hi, Dan. Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
I hope that's the proper pronunciation of your name. I didn't check beforehand.
It's Kozarev.
Ah, okay. There we go.
But Kozarev,
thank you. Thank you. I want to ask you how you came to this story, how you came to want to write this story, and your connection to this case and this story.
Well, Dr. Finch was our family doctor. He actually delivered me. And up until the time, well, just about 9 months before the murder, he remained our family doctor. And we'll talk about later why, even prior to the murder, he was no longer our family doctor. But for several years, I had been thinking about writing a book. It'd pop in out of my mind, and then I'd go on to other things. And the way this came about is I found out a friend was friends with one of the producers, former producers of Law and Order. And God, I thought, well, here's my break. You know, I'm going to be able to write something and get it. Maybe it'll get made. And so I actually started writing. I thought about three ideas, and I thought Satin Pumps would be the most commercial. So I started writing it as a treatment for a 10 to 12 episode limited series. And, got it together, gave it to my friend, he delivered it, and that's about as far as it got. The producer had other projects of his own he went on to, and I thought, you know, I spent all this time researching this and developing it. I said, I think there's a book in here. So I went back and started to shape it as a book, do a lot more in-depth character study. I actually got into genealogical research, which was a gold mine, because it actually gave me material and background as to why the characters did what they did. And it was very helpful going into that. And so I was able to cover areas in the book and get into detail that you never could in a limited television series.
You also gained access to Los Angeles Police Department, LA District Attorney's records. Maybe correct me about that.
Yeah, I had you know, I had a lot, I did a lot of research in newspaper archives. Actually, there were four major newspaper archives that I went through. And yet, I wanted to get into the district attorney's records about this, and actually the trial transcripts. And I had been misled to think that, you know, the court, Los Angeles Superior Court, actually had these. And I went there downtown and went into their sort of their dungeon to find out where they were. Mm-hmm. And they claimed they had no record of these. They couldn't find even a case file number, which is just really bizarre, because this was a major criminal trial that lasted, you know, over 18 months. So I started to do a little more research, and I thought, hey, I'm going to try the district attorney's office. And you don't really have easy access even on the internet to it. And I found some sort of back channel, I don't even remember how, on the internet. And this is, you know, detective work. And I sent off a note. And finally, after some doing, I got a response, and they had to search for the files themselves, but they actually located them. They were in an archive holding storage facility somewhere in the San Fernando Valley. So they pulled them, but they gave me limited access to them. I had, and it was very specific, you know, I had, like, so many hours a day. They had somebody there, I guess, to make sure that I wouldn't pocket the transcripts. And so I did have access, not as much as I wanted, but I was able to confirm some things by the access.
Now, let's start, as you do in the book, very exciting cinematic scene here, West Covina, California, July 19th, 1959, in the San Gabriel Valley. Bernard Finch, Dr. Bernard Finch, is running away from police. And you, meanwhile, saying at that time, a young boy, 6.5 miles away, you were in Charter Oak. As you do, describe this scene. Dr. Bernard Finch is running away from police.
He's running down the hill from his home across the South Hills Country Club, where he played tennis with his wife, Barbara. And there were still some orange groves that were left at the time. And as he's running through that area, he ends up into the orange groves trying to escape. And he starts tripping and actually ends up on his back at one point. But he gathers himself finally and continues on this run. And he ends up across the street at a neighbor's home. And there spots a car, and as many people did in the 1950s, they left their cars unlocked, and not only that, they left the keys in the ignition.
Yeah.
So he gets the car, and he steals it, and he starts driving, and he ends up in La Puente, and I'm thinking that in his state of mind, he thought he was going to pick up Carol Tregoff, his girlfriend, at her home with her former husband, but she was no longer living there. And she had actually moved to Las Vegas prior to this occurring. So he ends up in this La Puente neighborhood, ditches the one car, and then steals another. Same case. You know, doors unlocked, the keys in the ignition. And unfortunately, when he dumps the first car, he blocks the driveway of a policeman who is going to work. Morning. So he calls the police, you know, he gives them the car and finds out the car has been stolen. So Finch, at this point in the second car, is headed to the West Covina Medical Clinic. And as he spends some time there, as he pulls out of the driveway, the police at this point have been notified about him, and a patrol car spots him, and they give chase. And he jumps on the San Bernardino Freeway headed towards Los Angeles, which is about 20 miles away. And at this point, eventually there are 20 patrol cars that are speeding after him. And somehow he manages to elude them, gets off the freeway, and switches back and heads back in the other direction. But the police don't know that. They come across what they think is the same 1955 Cadillac they've been chasing. They run this car off the road. The car spins around in the median gravel strip. They run towards the car, guns drawn, and one officer flings the door open, and there's an elderly woman sitting in the driver's seat. So, obviously, they didn't catch Finch, who by now is, you know, halfway to Las Vegas. And that's how that scene ends in the book.
Right. Now, you go to telling us about Barbara Finch, that was 36 years old at the time of her death. Tell us about the situation with their marriage and when they were married, and also just the situation throughout this marriage and where they were at that point in when Barbara was 36 years old, 1959. Well,
yeah, Barbara was very beautiful, very bright, very smart, well-liked. She had been a patient of Finch's, and in fact, he delivered her first child, her daughter, Patty D. And she ended up, she was sort of in a marriage that wasn't going anywhere as far as she was concerned. She, her family at one time had had some money. And I think she missed, you know, all that came with being wealthy. She was married to an auto mechanic and living in Baldwin Park, which was kind of a dead-end town in the eastern San Gabriel Valley. And here she meets Finch. You know, he's wealthy, he's handsome, he's charming. And shortly after her baby's delivered, she ends up working for him as a medical assistant. And Finch had a habit at this point, but it's not so much known as it was later, that, you know, he was attracted to the ladies, and he had no problem with having extramarital affairs. Finch was married at this time, his first wife, Frances, and had three children by her. Barbara and her husband were living in Baldwin Park, and somehow Finch and Barbara orchestrated, and I don't know, this is just really bizarre, orchestrated Finch and his wife and children moving next door to Barbara and her husband in Baldwin Park.
Right.
So now they're literally physically close, if not, you know, romantically involved. And eventually, you know, the hours that she works with Finch, they turn into late nights, and, you know, her husband and Finch's wife, Frances, had to have been wondering, you know, what's going on. And they became involved, and eventually they wanted to get married. And you know, I'm sure Barbara's husband, Lyle, at the time, wanted to put a stop to it. And, you know, his threat was that he was going to take their daughter away. And Barbara right. wanted out of this marriage so badly that she was willing to make that deal to give up her parental rights at that point to her two-year-old daughter. So she and Finch ended up getting married in Las Vegas on near close to Christmas Eve. And they, at that point, had no home together. They were living in their separate apartments. He was in the process of building a hilltop home in West Covina that he designed. And it took about close to a year for it to be finished before they moved in there. And, you know, eventually Barbara's daughter, Patty, who was close to 11 at the time, ended up moving in there with them. And shortly after that, Barbara gave birth to Finch's son, Ramey. And the first couple years of their marriage, you know, in the home were great. They had quite a social life. They were members of the Los Angeles Tennis Club, where they played tennis with celebrities like Vera Allen and actor-director Mark Stevens. The Los Angeles Tennis Club, the president at the time, was Cornwell Jackson. And Cornwell Jackson was Earl Stanley Gardner's literary agent. And Cornwell was also married to Gail Patrick Jackson, who had been an actress in the 30s and 40s. And she was sort of retired, and she was looking for something to do. And through their association with Earl Stanley Gardner, the three of them decided to, she pitched the idea for the Perry Mason TV series, and basically Earl Stanley Gardner was on board, and she ended up selling it. So this is sort of the circles the Finches ran in. Right. They were also members of the South Hills Country Club, which was literally down the hill and right across the street from their home, golf course, tennis. And so, as I said, they could slum with the doctors and the lawyers in the eastern San Gabriel Valley if they didn't happen to have a handy celebrity around. So at the time of their divorce, which later occurred, their the Finch's estate was estimated to be about $6 million in 2021 dollars. He not only owned the home, but he was partnered with his brother-in-law, Gordon Franklin, in the West Covina Medical Clinic. And also they were taking a line of credit. They were building a hospital that was right adjacent to it. They also owned the labs. They had a lot of properties together. And so he was a pretty wealthy son. Finch's family goes way back into the history of the area. His grandfather was one of the founding fathers of the city of Covina. He helped drill one of the first water wells there. And Finch's father, also named Raymond, was a optometrist and a co-owner of a jewelry store that was well known in the area. And the Finches were well liked. They were very civic, very wealthy, very caring people, very religious people. But something changed with Bernie when, as he was growing up and became a doctor, and it just didn't seem to be enough for him. And so, well, when he was married to Barbara, like I said, the first couple of years were pretty good. And then he started to, you know, the way they had met was through an affair. Well, that didn't stop, you know, after he had married her.
That's
and
right.
A couple of years later, he ended up meeting Carol Tregoff. She was about 19. She was looking for a job. She was in a loveless marriage. And she was looking to do something. So she found an ad for a receptionist position at West Covina Medical Clinic and was hired. She worked in that for several months, and then Finch needed a medical assistant. His was retiring. So she applied for that job and was hired on a trial basis. And initially, they weren't involved sexually or romantically, you know. She knew that Finch was even carrying on with his nurse at this time. So she, you know, she had a pretty good idea what he was like. But eventually he started to ask her out for lunch, and they ended up, you know, being involved. And there was one interesting date that they had, what she considers her first romantic date, was at the Luau restaurant in Beverly Hills. And if anybody knows about that restaurant, it was a famous Polynesian restaurant that was owned by Stephen Crane, who was Lana Turner's husband. And it has quite a history. There's even a story about the time that Lena Horne was there. And some racist made a crude remark about her. And she picked up a lamp and threw it at him along with three other ashtrays and beamed the guy on the head. But Finch and Carol went to the Luau restaurant one night. They were drinking scorpions. They probably were a little tipsy. They may have been even asked to leave the restaurant. And they ended up in his 1957 Chrysler 300C convertible, a beautiful, expensive car. They ended up in the Hollywood Hills. And she didn't get home. Finch didn't get her home till about 4:30 in the morning. And her, you know, she's still married to her husband, Jimmy Papa, at this point, who's been up all night wondering where she's been. And when she comes into the door, you know, he wants answers, and she's not forthcoming and giving him anything. So Jimmy thinks he's going to get back at her, and he calls Finch, her employer, and tells him that she's been out all night. When little does Jimmy know, the person that Carol's been out all night is with Finch. And in my retelling in the book, I'm thinking, how did Finch stifle the laughter, you know? It had to have been pretty funny. But it wasn't funny to Jimmy. And, you know, he demanded, you know, he was telling Finch that she's not coming into work, she's been out all night, blah, blah, blah. And so she doesn't go in that night. And the next day or two is when Jimmy comes home from work, opens the front door, and the place is completely emptied of furniture, Carol, her clothes, and everything. And he makes a trip to the West Covina Medical Clinic to confront Finch and Carol about what's going on. And I'll give you a chance to get a question in here.
Use this as an opportunity to stop for a second for these messages. Now, you talked about, despite being married, Carol married to Jimmy Papa, and him having his suspicions. Now they're confirmed. She's moved out, taken everything, the furniture and everything she owned, and is out of that place. How does Finch deal with Barbara at the same time?
Well, she's heard rumors, and I think she sort of wanted to look the other way. She loved her position as being a socialite. And Jimmy Papa decides that he's going to – he has actually placed a couple calls to Barbara about this, and she's, you know, sort of states, you know, she's heard the rumors. And finally, after this happens, when Barbara actually realizes that this is a serious affair that Finch is having, she calls Papa. She wants him to talk to Carol to break this up. And at that point, this was prior to when that first date with Finch and Carol. This is just when things are starting to happen. And Jimmy had heard the rumors at the time, but, you know, they didn't believe him. You know, they had been, Carol and Finch had been spotted in Palm Springs, where she liked to water ski and he liked to play tennis. And, you know, when he's talking to Barbara, he says, well, they had a legitimate reason there. You know, they could have been seeing a patient and so on. And Barbara, you know, she's not buying that. You know, and then Jimmy finally says, well, you know, if you're afraid that there's adultery going on, why don't you just get a divorce? And she tells Jimmy she's already been through one marriage. She doesn't want another. And she's fearful of losing not only her status, but her financial, you know, access too. And at the time, California had no community property laws. If a wife could prove, or a husband could prove adultery, that spouse could end up with just about everything. And this starts to be a problem that starts brewing for Finch, because he realizes this, especially when Barbara finally has had enough and decides to file for divorce.
Let's talk about the West Covina Medical Clinic and this big home that he talked after they both left their prospective homes and their marriages. He talked about building this castle in West Covina, 4 miles from his state-of-the-art labs and clinic. Tell us a little bit about this and who eventually moves next door.
Well, he actually bought a couple lots, and he had added to them, and he ends up designing this home that's very similar in style to the institutional layout of the West Covina Medical Clinic. So it's actually kind of a cold. People who had been in the home thought there wasn't a lot of warmth in it, even though there was a swimming pool that the home was kind of U-shaped and built around the swimming pool. His father, who ends up retiring from his life as an optometrist, ends up buying the lot right on the other side of the driveway and builds a house there. So Barbara's in-laws are literally living across the driveway, and Finch's father is really a nice man. He's very loving, very thoughtful. He adores his daughter-in-law, and she does him. Finch's mother is an invalid. She's wheelchair-bound and not in very good health. And, you know, during when Barbara realizes and has had enough of his affairs, and particularly his affair with Carol, you know, his parents can hear the fighting that's going on up above and the screaming and everything. And some of this verbal abuse actually starts to turn physical. And Finch starts taking a couple cracks at Barbara. And there are cases where she's reported this to the police. In her divorce proceeding, she actually has gone to the attorney, her divorce attorney, with a cut over her eye. And she claims that Finch is trying to kill her. And I think Finch is so frustrated that he sees that possibly as a way out. And this is when he and Carol start to plan what they're going to do with Barbara. And they decide, you know, at this point, when Barbara's filing the divorce papers, Finch and Carol are worried that she's going to be named as a co-respondent. So she quits her job as his medical assistant, and she moves to Las Vegas, and she moves in with a childhood friend and his grandmother. And she gets a job at the Sands Hotel as a cocktail waitress. And she starts asking her friend, you know, do you know anybody? Do you know some bad dudes here? You know some bad guys in town? And I'm not so sure that she was specific, but she was looking for basically a hitman to do in Barbara. And her friend, Don, doesn't know anybody, but he knows somebody who might. He's taking a class at the University of Las Vegas. And so he contacts this guy, and then this guy apparently knows somebody. And this guy's name is Jack Cody. Jack Cody is a major character in the story, and literally quite a character. He's a con artist, but he's not a murderer. But they don't know that. But he will present himself to you any way he thinks he can get something out of you. So he basically is presenting himself as a bad dude to Carol, and Carol isn't street smart. She's really not a criminal. So she's listening to him, and she wants to believe, and so she's buying into what he's saying. So she talks to Finch, and they decide to basically hire Jack Cody to do Barbara in, and they pay him half of something that's just under $2,000 fee, which is really cheap. Now, the interesting thing I note here is she's working at the Sands Hotel, which was mobbed up at the time. Why didn't she approach an employee there who might have had a connection to basically a real hitman, you know, a real assassin?
Yeah.
But she didn't do that. And I think it's that they were just too cheap to pay what would it have cost to kill Barbara. So they decide to hire Jack Cody. You know, they pay him half the fee. And Cody, being a con man, he takes the money and, you know, basically gambles it away, drinks it away. And they had set a July 4th weekend for the time for him to go to Los Angeles and kill Barbara. Well, they come back, or Finch is back in Las Vegas with Carol, and Carol tells him, he calls Carol and says, well, I did the job. And Carol's very enthused, you know, that Barbara's out of the picture, and she calls Finch. Finch is just kind of a little doubting Thomas. He gets on the phone, he calls his home, and Barbara answers it. So she's very much alive. So they get a hold of Cody, and they want to know what went wrong. And Cody's got this wild story, you know, hey, I killed a woman. I put her body in the trunk of a car. I used that shotgun. And then Finch all of a sudden says, well, you must have killed her friend by accident. Barbara had been staying with, when she was running and trying to hide from Finch during the physical abuse, she'd stay with a friend in Hollywood. And so he says, you killed the wrong woman. And Jack Cody says, well, I'll go back and do it right. And there is another attempt made, but what happens this time is basically Jack Cody takes the money, he goes to Los Angeles, and he ends up having a friend drive him back to Las Vegas where he gathers his things, and he heads back to Minnesota where he's from and never does the job. And at that point, that's the last that Carol and Finch see of Jack Cody. But now they're faced with having to take care of Barbara themselves. And they did have a plan B. And this involved neutralizing her, injecting her with Seconal, and then a second injection, which would put an air bubble in her bloodstream and kill her. They were going to place her body in the Chrysler, this beautiful car, place her body in the car, and send it over the ravine, which is next to the house. And their hope was that it would look like an accident, that she had died a natural death due to the car crashing over the side of the hill. And that's sort of where the plan is at this point. And I'll take a moment here before I get into what really happened after that.
Okay, so now we're talking about they're trying to put this plan into motion. Let's talk about the night before and what their plan is to be able to do this, Carol and Bernard. What do they have to do? What do they have to get set to be able to put this into action, this plan to murder Carol?
Well, they started doing some shopping. He obviously has access to syringes, Seconal, and so on. And they end up buying some other items. They end up buying some fishing. Well, that's not fishing line. I guess it's actually some kind of cord that could be used to moor a boat with. But it's very thin. And they were going to use this to tie her up. And they put all these things together into a valise. And when Carol gets off of work about 6 o'clock the evening of the 18th, she picks up Finch, who had been staying at their apartment in Las Vegas. The case is in the back seat. She's in her just 55 bronze and white DeSoto convertible, which is a beautiful car. And they're making this five-hour drive from Las Vegas to West Covina under the pretense, you know, they're telling themselves basically that they're going to talk to her about a divorce, about Barbara moving to Las Vegas to get a speedy divorce. That's what they would later tell, investigators and police. So they drive to Las Vegas. I mean, they drive to West Covina. Barbara, at this point, has earlier in the day left the home in the Chrysler, and she's driven to the Los Angeles Tennis Club for a game of doubles, and with a girlfriend of hers, the woman's fiancé, and then another man who turns out to be her divorce attorney's investigator. And they play doubles. Go have drinks at the country club, and then they go out to a local steakhouse for dinner. They come back to the country club. Barbara picks up her car, and she drives back. And just about the time that Finch and Carol are arriving in West Covina, parking the car at the South Hills Country Club parking lot, Barbara is starting to drive back from the Los Angeles Tennis Club on the San Bernardino Freeway to her home in West Covina. Once Finch and Carol park the car, he gets out. He's going to surveil the property first. He walks up the hill on the side of his father's property and then up his driveway to avoid being seen by anybody. But there's a major spotlight, floodlight on the property, which he pulls the cord out of. And he looks around. He doesn't see anybody. He realizes that she's gone. So he motions and waves at Carol down below the hill to come up. She brings this valise with these items, the Seconal, the syringes, the rope, flashlight. There's gloves in there, surgical gloves. Everything that they need is in this case, and she walks up the hill with this case. Now they're waiting sort of hidden on the lawn for Barbara to show up. And as she does, as she drives into the car, and stops the car, she turns off the engine, but not the ignition, so that the radio and the headlights are still on in the car. And as she's starting to come up, Finch sneaks up behind her, and with the butt of the gun, he strikes her on the head, which sort of knocks her senseless and causes a concussion. She's laying on the floor, and just prior to this, she had been struggling with, she had called out, I guess it was actually right at that point. She comes to, and she calls out to Marie Ann, who is the 19-year-old nanny that takes care of the two children in the house. Right. Marie Ann was still up. The kids were asleep. She was curling her hair in the bathroom. So she hears Barbara screaming, and she runs out into the garage. And as Finch is struggling with Barbara, Marie Ann comes in, and she turns on the lights. Finch runs for Marie Ann. Barbara is now laying on the garage floor again. Finch has hit her a second time. Finch runs over to Marie Ann, shoves her head into the garage wall, causing an indentation, and actually bangs her head a couple times trying to neutralize her. She collapses. She's momentarily stunned. And the next thing she realizes when she comes to, Finch has pulled a gun. And he's motioning her into the back seat of the car, and he's dragging Barbara, who was revived, into the front seat of the car. And to scare Marie Ann, he actually fires the gun. Now, Carol, who had not actually come into the garage, is waiting nearby. And once she hears that first shot, she reportedly told people she hid for hours in the bougainvillea bush that was on the property. But in reality, she told a reporter early on in the case, that she actually took off when she heard that first gunshot, which is the warning shot Finch fired in the garage. So she starts running, and Finch now has to deal with Carol and Marianne, or with Barbara and Marianne on his own. So he gets into the car, and he's looking for the keys to the car because he's going to drive this car now. Instead of one passenger, there's going to be two that are going to go over the side of the cliff, is his thought process. He had taken Barbara's purse. He dumped the contents on the floor of the garage looking for the keys, and then he realized that the keys are in the ignition because the lights and the radio are on.
Right, right.
So as he does that, Barbara bolts. She's come to. She bolts out of the car and starts running down the hill. And he comes around the side of the car and gives chase. And at that point, Marianne gets out of the car and runs in the house to call police. As Barbara is running down the driveway, Finch is after her. She crosses the driveway and starts to, it's broken one of her high heels. She's running literally 1 foot in one high heel, and she's trying to go down these 7 dirt steps into her to seek asylum at her in-laws. And she had told their divorce attorney before that's what she would do. So as she starts to run down these steps, Finch actually fires a gun and shoots her in the back. She collapses in the backyard and dies in the backyard. And that's where we are at this point.
So now we have where he obviously steals the vehicle and then a subsequent another vehicle. The police officer with the first vehicle gets blocked in his driveway. He calls police. So now police, an alert police officer remembers details about Carol Tregoff. And so he ascertains that she's in Vegas, and they go to, or remembers that she works at the Sands. So they go to the Sands and talk to her. Tell us what they ask her to do and what happens as a result.
Well, there's two astute police officers. One works for the West Covina Police. He remembered that because Finch and Carol and her ex-husband had once lived near him. And he knew that she had moved to Las Vegas. So now the Las Vegas sheriffs have heard about this, and they believe that Finch is on his way there, and they know that Carol works at another Las Vegas sheriff knows that Carol, he had stopped her for an infraction with her car. I think she had a busted taillight. So he knows that she works at the Sands Hotel. So one detective goes to the Sands Hotel, and this is about early in the morning. She had actually driven back to Las Vegas. So they're talking to her, and he's asking her about Finch, and she says, well, yeah, he's slept at my apartment overnight. And so they go there, and he gets a backup, and the two detectives go over there and pick up Finch and bring him in for questioning at the Las Vegas Sheriff's Department. Then about 90 minutes later, they go back there. At this time, Carol has already gotten off of work. She's gone home. And now she's sleeping in the same bed that Finch was, and they roused her, and they haul her in for questioning. They're not so sure that she's directly involved, but they also think that there may be a link. So she's not being held. She's not under detainment, though they managed to kind of convince her. And this would prove problematic later on because it forced her to do things that she might not have. She actually made a statement. The police were detaining Finch until the Las Vegas sheriff was detaining Finch until the West Covina Police Department could send a couple detectives up who were flying in to pick him up. And she made a statement. She promised to go back to West Covina to be interviewed, to be a witness. And so that happened. And then eventually the detectives did come and pick up Finch and bring him back. They took a plane to Ontario Airport, and then they drove in, and they brought him to the property to walk around. And that's where he met his criminal attorney, Grant Cooper, who became famous later on for defending Sirhan Sirhan, among other notables. And so Finch, the police are looking for the one thing that happened is that just prior to Finch being on the run the previous night, he had gone back to the garage and picked up Barbara's purse and the contents. He went back and where she died, he actually found the bullet and the shell casing. And he gathered all these items, plus a gun. And so when he was on the run from police initially, when he stole the two cars, he actually had her purse, the bullet, the shell casing, and all the contents in it. The police were not obviously able to find them in the properties of Finch and his father, but they had been searching, and they had even used a metal detector and were coming up empty-handed to find anything. So Finch agrees to take them on a tour of the property, and he toys with them at this point. It's really kind of bizarre. He's leading them on to believe that he knows where the gun and the bullet and the shell casing are, and he's taking around the property. The reporters are following along. Everybody's excited. They think Finch is going to take them to the gun. And finally, he works them up into this frenzy. He gets them down. They walk down to the Lark Allen, which borders on the Finch home above the hilltop and the South Hills Country Club. And he comes down. He goes, "You know, I just don't know." And he drops them cold. And I'm sure if there wasn't a physical sigh, collective sigh among the police and the reporters, there was at least a mental one.
Police also talked to Bernie's father, who, of course, lives next door. And what does he tell them about what he about something he heard the night before and his reaction to those sounds, what he did the next day?
You know, he was in denial, and I think he was afraid if he paid too much attention that his worst fears would come true. He heard the two gunshots, but he initially wanted to believe that it was cars backfiring and didn't really do anything. He'd gone to bed, and the next morning, he was an early riser, and about 6 a.m., he looks out his window, and there he notices a police presence on his son's property. And, you know, he's still thinking that, well, maybe the place was robbed. So he decides he's going to investigate, and he walks up, and the police really don't spot him. They don't stop him. It's one of the problems with being an older person. They just don't care. And he walks literally onto the property. He finds what would later be termed the murder kit, the valise with all the Seconal, the syringes and everything, which is basically in plain view. It's to the side of the house, but he finds him. He finds his Alpine hat that Finch was wearing. He picks those up, and he walks into the house. And because he still thinks it might be possibly a robbery, he starts looking around the home, and he goes to a hiding place where he knows the Finches hid their valuables in there. And he finds a silverware tray. Inside are Barbara's wedding rings. So he pockets those. He puts the silverware tray back, and he walks back into his house with the murder kit and the Alpine hat. And nobody, you know, he holds on to him for a couple days. And this would later prove problematic during the trials. The police would actually lie about how they acquired the Alpine, the Alpine hat and the murder kit. But it was several days later when they were still looking, you know, searching the property for evidence that he actually offered them to detectives. And one of the detectives had a key to the case that they had found in Finch's personal belongings in Las Vegas when he was picked up by the Las Vegas sheriffs. So they try the keys, and one of the key opens the Alpine or opens the murder kit, and inside they find all this damning evidence. The Seconal, there's a liquid form of it, there's a viral of it, there's pill form, there's syringes in there. I mean, this is stuff a doctor wouldn't normally carry to help somebody. It would be something that a person would carry around to murder somebody. So they had this damning evidence now, and when Finch was brought back after the search of the property, he was housed in the Covina jail because West Covina did not have holding facilities, and he was booked, fingerprinted, and everything. Carol had driven down the morning of his hearing, and they had some alone time together. And my thought is that when they were alone, he promised Carol that he would keep her out of any involvement with his case, that he would not give her up. And she, reporters noticed that when she exited the car, she was smiling. And the next thing is the Finch hearing, which was quite dramatic and quite the show.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages from our sponsor. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why, especially when it comes to something we take every day. Ritual's clean, vegan-friendly multivitamin is formulated with high-quality nutrients in bioavailable forms your body can actually use. What you won't find, sugars, GMOs, major allergens, synthetic fillers, and artificial colorants. Plus, the fresh taste and delayed release capsule design, taking your vitamins easy. I chose to take Ritual Essential for Men 50 Plus about 6 weeks ago when it became available. I decided to try it because my wife Lisa has been taking Ritual Essential for Women for about 10 months or so, and she was very happy with the results of taking Ritual daily. She felt it made a significant difference, and I wanted to experience Ritual for myself. Their research into bioavailable vitamin mineral sources sold me on Ritual. They are a superior multivitamin. Ritual is the multivitamin reimagined. A multivitamin should contain key nutrients and forms your body can actually use to help gaps in your diet. No shady extras. Ritual's delayed release capsule design delivers high quality nutrients, including vitamin D3, in just 2 daily pills. Your multivitamins are delivered to your door every month with free shipping always. You can start, snooze, or cancel your subscription anytime. And if you don't love Ritual within your first month, they'll refund your first order. Get key nutrients without the BS. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off during your first 3 months. Visit ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. We last left off, we did not mention what police found at the Hilltop home of Carol, and in the state that police found her body. What was that state? What did the police find in terms of evidence at the crime scene?
There wasn't a whole lot. They found her broken heel, so they knew she had been running, and then they found her other heel, which was intact a few yards from her body. She had been shot in the back. The bullet had severed an artery, and basically she bled internally and very quickly. The bullet did likely exit her body because Finch found it. They were never able to find that bullet or even the shell casing. So that was about that. Finch was initially arrested, he claimed that he had been in Las Vegas the whole time, and then eventually said, well, yeah, he was there. And this is when they started to formulate their story about that they had gone to see Barbara that night, they were going to talk to her about a divorce, and that she pulled a gun on them, and she had it in the Chrysler, and that there was a struggle over the gun. There were actually two struggles over the gun. The second struggle is Finch claims that he had disarmed her, and in the process, he threw the gun down, and it discharged and shot her in the back. And that was his story as to how she ended up dying by being shot, and how he was there, but he didn't do it.
When Carol was questioned, and you say that they wanted to question them concurrently at first, question them so that they couldn't get any more of the story straight if they had even had any opportunity to speak to it. Did Carol corroborate that account that Barbara had pulled the gun on them?
She claims, yeah, that that had happened, but later on she claimed that she had run into the bougainvillea bush and hid there for 4 or 5 hours before she drove off, that the police came, they didn't find her, that she was hidden in this, and she stuck to this through the whole case. But there was an interesting thing I came across, and I don't know how the police missed this, is that early on in the case, she spoke to a reporter, and you would have had to really do some digging to find this. She actually told the reporter that she had left and was on the run when she heard the first, or she ran when she heard the first shot, which was a warning shot he fired, and that she was actually a block away when the second shot was fired that killed Barbara. And I believe at that point she was just pure fright. She just jumped in that car and she took off. She did not stay around. She did not actually see Finch shoot Barbara. And she didn't see much of what was going in the garage. She disappeared as when she heard Marie Ann coming into the garage, she had been, you know, hiding sort of in the back of the entrance to the garage while Finch was fighting with Barbara. And when Marie Ann came in, the nanny came into the garage, is when Carol exited, and she claimed she hid in the bougainvillea bush. I think she stayed to the side of the property where she couldn't be seen, but there wasn't much time between when Marie Ann came in and Finch fired that warning shot. So she might have even started running just as soon as Marie Ann came in, but she definitely was on the run when she heard that first warning shot, because Marie Ann claims she never saw her, which I believe was true, and she was not physically involved in the actual murder, you know, killing Barbara, even though she had plotted and she conspired to do her in.
Now, let's fast forward to these people being charged, both of them, but Carol's situation is a little bit different in the beginning. And we alluded in the introduction about her being arrested after testifying. Explain this for the conditions in which Carol eventually is arrested and charged for murder.
Well, over the weekend, there was quite a bit of media play. You know, Finch was a well-known doctor in the Eastern San Gabriel Valley, and the press, television, radio got a hold of it. So that by the Monday of the hearing in West Covina, a lot of people knew about it. And people in the area who knew the Finch name or were their patients, a lot of them, mostly women who didn't work, came to the hearing in the small courtroom, Citrus Court in West Covina. And there was a folksy judge, Albert Miller, who was quite a character presiding. And Finch had been charged. He was at the hearing, but he did not testify. And one of the witnesses they put on the stand was Carol. And at this point, police thought she had some involvement, but they weren't sure. And Carol arrives at the hearing wearing one of Barbara's mink trim suits and sunglasses. She looks like a movie star going to a premiere. And she's accompanied by her stepmother, Gladys, very much a great relationship. It couldn't have been closer if they had been actual biological mother and daughter. And so she sits down. She's called as a witness. She gets up on the stand. And she's questioned by the assistant district attorney. And during the line of questioning, it seems to be that she's been more involved than what they thought. And she actually confirms that she's had a sexual relationship with Finch. And it creates quite a furor at this point, because she breaks down on the stand, starts crying, and the judge calls for a recess and allows Carol and her stepmother, Gladys, to go into his chambers, and he talks to them. And I don't think he realized what he was doing at the time, but it's almost like coaching. And this would prove really problematic through the following trials, what he did.
Right.
He was himself called as a witness. But she gets back on the stand, and when it looks like the testimony is over, the judge, Albert Miller, turns to the assistant district attorney and says, well, I guess she can be excused now. And the ADA turns to him and he says, Your Honor, as soon as she steps off that stand, we're going to arrest her. And they did. And she was as surprised as anybody. And I think she, in her mind, thought she was being arrested more for stating she had a sexual affair with Finch than actually shooting Barbara. And the court is in an uproar. She's hauled out. The reporters are following. There's a famous photo of her being let out by one of the West Covina detectives to a holding cell. And they ask her, did you think you were going to be arrested? And she goes, I certainly did not. And her mother is kind of a drama queen, and she can't believe what's happened. She's trying to, you know, implore the reporters as though they could do something about it. Excuse me. And so she and Finch are hauled off to Los Angeles County Jail on a bus with other people who had been arrested for other crimes in the area.
What about attorneys for both of them? Who did they get? I know Carol hired Robert Neeb, and he was famous for defending Charlie Chaplin, Errol Flynn, Bugsy Siegel, Robert Mitchum. Tell us about representatives for Dr. Finch.
And Neeb was a partner of Jerry Geisler, who was a very famous criminal attorney. And he, like you said, he defended Charlie Chaplin. At this point, he had also been hired by Helen Besolo, who was George Reeves' mother. And as you probably know, George Reeves played Superman on television, died in a very mysterious way, being shot in the back. And, you know, obviously the coroner was quick to wrap that up and call it a suicide, but even to this day, it's still questionable as how he really died. But Helen Besolo had hired Jerry Geisler to investigate her son's murder, and this had happened just about a month prior to the Finch-Tregoff murder. So Jerry Geisler's office, Robert Neeb, is going to represent Carol. Finch has hired his attorney, Ned Nelson, who was not a criminal attorney, and he may have referred Finch to Grant Cooper. And so Grant Cooper was not at the hearing. He had sent an associate of his, because he might have been out of town or on another case. I can't recall at this point, but he was not at the original hearing. And let's see. Ask me another question.
So now they have Grant Cooper, a very qualified attorney, to represent Dr. Finch. There is a challenge to change the venue because they don't think they're going to be able to get a fair trial given all the publicity. And there is also the one legal issue that's important is, did Carol give evidence in violation of her constitutional rights?
Yes, that's what they were talking about with her on the stand. And this would be something that would be a major sticking point in the case, in the prosecution case, when it actually did come to trial. I might also mention that at the hearing in West Covina, Gail Patrick Jackson and her husband, Cornwell Jackson, were at, you know, because they were president of the tennis club and friends of the Finches, they were also at the hearing. And I think she might have also been looking for material for the Perry Mason TV series. You know, she wasn't going to pass up the opportunity. So there were, you know, some celebrities at that hearing.
And also a famous media queen that you mentioned as well, that she made also a grand entrance. When you talk about later about Carol making an entrance, but this media queen, this journalist, was treated like a queen by the judge and made quite the entrance herself and was of major importance herself at that time.
Yeah, when the trial actually took off on January 5th, 1960, and they had moved it to a larger venue, which was called the Circus Room at the Metropolitan Courthouse in downtown Los Angeles, the trial initially had been moved was going to be in Los Angeles or Pomona Superior Court. But Grant Cooper, I think, really didn't want to drive that far. He lived in Hancock Park. So he managed to move the trial downtown. And they actually had to move it to a larger, it was going to be in the Hall of Justice, but it only sat about 99 people. So they moved it to the new Metropolitan Courthouse. There was this huge venue called what was referred to as a hippodrome or the circus room. It sat over 200 people. And so come January 5th, you know, a couple months have passed. There's been a lot of media interest, a lot of photos taken of Carol. This looks to be a major trial. So British author Eric Ambler is there. And Dorothy Kilgallen has been sent by the Hearst Syndicate to cover the paper. Excuse me. And she shows up through the front doors with two copy boys on either side carrying her typewriter and makes this grand entrance. And she's brought a couple friends with her, too, Clifton Webb and Sonia Henney, and Cobina Wright, who was a society maven. And she enters, and the judge pins her with an orchid. And she had almost as much attention as Carolyn Finch did. And she had a lot of access to them for interviews. And there were a lot of photos taken of her there. And she was still appearing on What's My Line, so on the weekend she would fly back to New York to appear on What's My Line on Sunday night, and then probably take a red eye back the following day to be, you know, in court in Monday morning in Los Angeles. And she covered the first trial, you know, which lasted for weeks, I think a couple months. And her columns were syndicated in all the Hearst newspapers. And she had a penchant for younger men. She was involved with Johnny Ray, the singer. And she took a liking to the two court bailiffs during the Finch trial, and she wrote about them in her columns and apparently talked about getting them screen tests. And I think she actually got a screen test for one of them. I don't think anything happened, but she loved younger guys.
Now, the prosecution's trying to prove their theory that, and they have about that there was a plan to murder Carol, and it included the second all and many of the things that were in that valise that you say, the attaché case, the murder kit. So they have to prove that in court, but they also use witnesses. Marie-Anne is one of the witnesses that they use to prove this case, but also there are friends of Barbara. And tell us about some of these witnesses and their testimony that helped the prosecution mount their case.
Key witnesses here. Eventually, though, they didn't, not so much, you know, during this trial. There was Marie-Anne, who was a Swedish au pair, and she had a key piece of evidence that everyone was surprised about. She had written her mother a letter to Sweden the previous May, and she talked about Finch and Barbara fighting, and Barbara, who confided in her and said that her husband tried to kill her, that he would either try and drive her up into the mountains and do it or out to the desert where nobody would ever find her body. So it not only confirmed that there was a plot in the works, but how it would have been done. And the murder kit played into that. And Marie-Anne was very believable. She initially fumbled a little bit because it was the first time on the stand, but as she became, you know, the longer she spent as a witness, she was, Grant Cooper could not disarm her, no matter what he tried to do. She stuck to her guns. She was very believable. Now, the other witness who was not initially believed by everybody because he was a con man was Jack Cody, who had been involved in this initial conspiracy. And the thing is that Jack Cody, you know, he had a life of crime here. He couldn't be scared or, you know, by the prosecution. The prosecution, by the defense attorneys. And Grant Cooper tried to destroy him, as did Carol's attorneys. And he would just sort of back talk to them and say these, kind of wild, funny things. But whatever he said was honest, and they could not ruffle him. And he eventually proved to be one of the other, the main reason that they were eventually convicted. And he presented this story, and as wild as it seemed about this murder conspiracy, it made sense. And but his life as a con artist did work against him, but ultimately he was telling the truth. There were a couple other people that were involved, a lesser degree. Barbara's friends were also put on the stand. She had a friend who lived in Palm Springs where Finches would go to play tennis and then drive to Salton Sea to go water skiing. And she recalled one instance actually about a day before Barbara was murdered. And Barbara was looking for another place to hide out. And she called her, and her name was Manette Haber. And she asked her about staying with her for a few days in Palm Springs to escape burning. And Manette says, well, it's 120 degrees here, and the air conditioning isn't working in the guest room. And so that sort of dissuaded Barb, and she said she'd think about it and get back to her. But Barbara never called her back, and then the following night is when she was murdered. There was a friend that she, a young school teacher that she had met playing tennis, who lived in a Hollywood apartment, was engaged, and she had a female roommate, and Barbara would stay with them occasionally. And that's where Jack Cody claimed that he had killed Barbara and stuffed her body in the trunk, but hadn't. And she was quite a character when she was up on the stand giving her testimony. She'd sigh, and sometimes she didn't get the questions. I mean, she sort of seemed to be somewhat naive, and she generated a lot of laughter when she was giving testimony, but she told the truth. And those were sort of the key witnesses.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, we talked about these two, the trial itself. Let's talk about Carol's testimony at this first trial.
She wasn't a lot forthcoming. You know, she obviously was there with Finch, but she didn't, she often said she didn't know things or wasn't aware. And the district attorney, the partner, the second attorney, lead attorney on this, was able to, you know, get underneath her skin, but, they didn't get a whole lot out of her. Like they should have. She just wouldn't answer a lot of the questions. They did read her trial transcript. Not her trial transcript, but they did read her statement to Las Vegas police. She was actually out on bail. She managed to make bail, and she was living with her family in Pasadena. So she had a lot of freedom that obviously Finch being locked up didn't.
You talked about the media's response to this and the reporting on this sensationalist case. You also talk about the reporting specifically about Carol, not only about her performance on the stand and whether that was effective or not and her reaction on the stand, but also other things about her personally.
Yeah, she, living with her parents,
she had certainly gained some weight, and they were commenting on that, like that was an important issue.
She was treated kind of like a celebrity. They loved photographing her, and yet they would treat her like they did a lot of women and still do at the time today, about her weight gains, which generally happened while she was incarcerated when she wasn't out on bail, and she had less access to clothing and hair and makeup and so on. There is an interesting point where she is allowed to take a pair of shoes in that she's wearing when she's arrested finally and held in L.A. County Jail. And one of the things they would not allow women to do, you could not bring in shoes for somebody through a third party. They were afraid that, like with high heels, that somebody could be stashing narcotics in them, which is just really kind of bizarre, but that was their thought. So she ended up wearing these red high heels, which she became known for in a lot of her court appearances. She was pretty much wearing those the whole time.
Let's talk about what happens when they finally rest their cases and the jury gets to deliberate. What are they facing? What are they facing, too, potentially, in terms of sentences?
Interesting for a trial at the time, and even for Los Angeles in 1960, is that the jury was mixed. There was an African-American man and a Latino man on it. And I don't remember coming across or seeing a lot of cases of that happening at the time. Generally, the juries were all white. Mm-hmm. And also, unfortunately, there was also a woman who was a racist on it. And she locked heads with the African-American man and Latino man. And they decided to, the two men decided they were going to, it was going to be them against the other people. And this actually caused what happened is they could not reach an agreement due to the racism that was going on. There was actually alleged altercations, physical threats made of one of the men allegedly picking up a chair and saying he was going to break the window and throw the woman out through it.
Wow.
But what was interesting is that the window couldn't even be opened. And apparently the couple of the women on the jury ran to get the bailiffs. I mean, there was pandemonium in the jury room when this was going on that was unbeknownst to Carroll and Finch while this was happening. They could not come to an agreement. There was a mistrial called. And it was actually due to racism that they were spared the gas chamber or being convicted at that point, even though they would have to go through it all over again. Dorothy Kilgallen apparently had, somebody was leaking some information to her out of the jury. There was a mole in the jury. And after the jury was excused and they were leaving the courthouse, she was out front and she spotted the African-American man, a Latino man. And she motioned him over. Obviously, they recognized her. And she said, let's have some drinks and talk about this. So she earlier knew about a secret taxi phone. In those days, a lot of hotels or buildings had a little box that had a direct line to a taxi company. So you could get a cab just by picking up the phone. It'd be there in moments. And right. She had been tipped off by a newspaper vendor on the street that this phone existed behind a bush. So she ran over there, picked up the phone, called a cab, and she whisked these guys off to her hotel room at the Ambassador and was able to interview them. And lo and behold, one of the men pulls out a journal that he had been kept, that he kept during the trial. So she had a lot of access to information about this, though she never really revealed that the trial it was called a mistrial due to the racism because of the times. It was just generally accepted. That was the case. And she was never found out exactly who was her mole in the jury and how she was getting tipped off to so much information. But the trial was going to be, it was rescheduled by the district attorney. And they were, Finch and Carroll, now we're going to have to go through a second trial.
What was any difference in the trial, at least in the approach by the prosecution? Was there, I mean, obviously they had not got a conviction. What was their strategy, if anything, to do differently with the second trial?
They thought they would run it chronologically. They thought that people, that the jurors lost track of the case because they had people out of sequence, and so they were going to do it in a chronological order the next time. But even then, when that happened, it wasn't much better. All the juries ended up going to the Finch home. They did field trips, to the Finch home and surveilled the property. And it was conducted just like they were in court. The judge was the only one who could speak. There was silence otherwise. Finch managed to escape a couple minutes and see his mother. He was able to get away and do that. But they did make they did make visits to the Finch home during the first and the second trials. And still, the second trial resulted in a mistrial after all that. Now they were faced with a third trial, and which also went to the Finch home. At this point, though, you know, you're into this over a year, and everybody is tired. They're looking to get to the finish line. And the third trial was much speedier. By then, a lot of the media hoopla had died down. Dorothy Kilgallen was long gone. She lasted through just the first trial. Eric Ambler was gone. It was still being reported, but not quite the circus that it had been up to that point. And so it was a little speedier. Grant Cooper was gone. His assistant was now in charge of Finch. And like I said, the third jury had gone to the Finch home to look at the property. And during the course of the trial, there was something that just didn't make sense. They just didn't quite buy Finch's story about how his wife did. During the first trial, there were female jurors that were crying when Finch was on the stand giving his testimony. And he was quite a great actor. It was like a soap opera, as the district attorney would later say. And the women are crying as he's telling this melodramatic story how after the struggle with the gun and Barb was shot, he ran down the steps to his dying wife, held her in his arms, and she said, "Bernie, I should have listened to you. Take care of the children." And the women are crying. And, you know, the jury, most of them pretty much bought that at the time. By the time of the third trial, though, people were having their doubts as to what the way that Bernie said that his wife died. So they actually asked the judge. They were the only jury. They went back for a second visit to the property. And something must have kicked in then as to just the being on the physical place again. And then the key thing is that they reenacted the way, amongst themselves, the jurors reenacted the way that Finch claimed his wife died. And they came to the conclusion it's physically impossible that this could have happened. And the other key thing is that this jury also believed Jack Cody, where the others didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And so those two things, the fact that Barbara couldn't have died the way Finch said, and Jack Cody, is what ultimately convicted him. And Finch, who had been a golden boy of San Gabriel Valley for decades, was just dumbfounded that he was convicted. He just couldn't believe it. It's the first time. I mean, he had gotten off drunk driving charges as a doctor, driving the Chrysler around, speeding, and you know, he gets stopped by the police, and they just let him go. And, you know, you talk about your white male privilege. He definitely had it. And, he was just dumbstruck that he was convicted, as was Carol. And they were both convicted for conspiracy. And even though Carol did not touch the gun, did not shoot Barbara, both she and Finch, at this point, could be facing the death penalty. They could have died in the gas chamber. So now they had to wait, I think it was a week, until the sentencing hearing as to what was actually going to happen to them.
You also, what we didn't mention is that, there's so much that we can't talk about, we don't have time, but in the second trial, it was very interesting that the judge, Dawson, urged the jurors to come to a conclusion to settle this and not have a mistrial again, and to believe Cody. So there was impropriety in terms of what he was doing at that trial. So it must have gave attorneys for Finch and maybe even Dr. Finch in his mind that it looked pretty good if he could survive a couple trials and have mistrials for this, that the prospects wouldn't be so bad for the third trial.
Yeah, Judge Dawson was an interesting case. As soon as he was announced that he would be heading the second trial, Finch and Carroll's attorneys tried to get rid of him. And I can't tell. He had a great record as far as convictions, but I couldn't tell. It was almost like it was something personal that they wanted not to have to deal with him. They made every effort to have to prevent him from conducting that second trial. And I think, you know, there's no actual record of it, but I think he was so mad about what they tried to do that he was going to make sure they were convicted. And I think they didn't get a fair trial, as you said, because once the jury was sort of deadlocked and he talked to the jurors, he told them that he thought they were guilty and that they should, you know, come to a majority conclusion on here. And, you know, Grant Cooper is just dumbstruck. You know, he's objecting and he's held in contempt. He's cited, I think, contempt twice by Dawson.
Yeah.
And this actually carried on, you know, through the court after this trial was over. And it was just, it's an amazing part of the book about this Dawson as to what went on.
You talk about the sentencing. Tell us what they were sentenced to and what happened in practical, well, in actual terms, considering their parole.
They were convicted of conspiracy to murder, so Carol could basically be facing the same sentence as Finch, even though she did not hold a gun and she did not kill Barbara. And so they went back to county jail, and that very night that they were convicted, but before the sentencing, Finch likely heard that famous Western swing musician Spade Cooley, who had his own variety show that was popular across the country, had killed his wife, had beaten her to death, and had been arrested. So that couldn't have been too good of an omen, you know, and he must have been wondering what likely he might be facing. And also, in the midst of all this, Carol Chessman, who had fought, I think, 12 years on death row to avoid the death penalty for rape, was finally executed. So the fact that if they would convict, you know, they would execute Carol Chessman for rape, what would they think of doing for Finch, who had actually murdered his wife, which was much worse? So it must have weighed heavily on him that they could have well gotten the gas chamber. But at the sentencing hearing, they were actually sentenced to life in prison. You know, and there's two different things that happened. Finch breathed a sigh of relief because he thought was going to die. But Carol realized she was going to be in prison for a long time, and she actually told Finch, she goes, "I'm going to be an old lady by the time I get out." And she was very upset, and there was sort of a break in their relationship at that point. And she sort of got out of there as soon as she could. And, you know, Finch was happy. Grant Cooper was happy because Grant Cooper, when he saw the jurors' faces, he was pretty sure that they were going to give Finch the death penalty. And we could talk about what happened after they were sentenced and spent time in prison.
Yeah, let's talk about that. But what you do answer for everyone wondering, what happened to that weapon that they never found? What happened to the shell casings? What happened to other evidence? You take us back to the high-speed pursuit and Dr. Finch going back to his clinic, and you tell us what happened.
Yeah, it would seem very odd for him. Why would somebody run on the run for murder, drive to their medical clinic, and be there such a short period of time? And I believe that he actually, because we know he had, at some point, he had the purse, the gun, the shell casing, and the shell in his possession. And he never admitted to what happened to them. The police never found it. And he claimed, you know, that he was in sort of a hypnotic state. When he drove back to Las Vegas, he didn't really even remember what he did. He just remembered. He sort of snapped out of it on his way when he was near Las Vegas. Yeah, you know, and but he never did tell what happened to that. I believe that when he went to the medical clinic, he took the purse, the shell casing, the gun, and the shell. He ran into the medical clinic, and he went to like a hazmat receptacle and put them in the trash at this hazmat receptacle, the very bottom, knowing that it's unlikely anybody would be going through it and that it would be picked up, you know, because it's dangerous trash and disposed of. And I think that's what happened with those. What I don't understand is how the police never thought about that, never investigated it. As far as I could not find any evidence that they ever went to the medical clinic searching for evidence. And I think it's something as simple as that is really how he disposed of the gun, the shell casing, and the purse.
Yeah, it sure makes a lot of sense. So let's talk about their stay in prison, both of these two characters. What happens?
He's kind of a model prisoner. The warden reports that he has a great singing voice. He plays tennis. Oh, yeah. I believe he worked in the prison library. He's initially spends time in San Quentin, and then he's transferred to Chino, men's state, where Carol is at the women's version of that prison nearby. She gets out about 7 or 8 years after, I believe she was released in 1969. She did a name change, and yet she never left the area. She ended up working at an inner community hospital in the medical records department. And even with the name change, all the employees knew who she was. And, you know, once she was on vacation, they'd be chattering amongst themselves about her. And she worked there for decades. She was promoted to the head of the records department and then eventually retired. She, up to the present, she's still alive. She's in her early 80s. She would be occasionally spotted in the Covina area. She was spotted by Jimmy Papa's sister at a supermarket in Covina a few years ago. And she told the sister, she says, "I earned every gray hair in my head." And I'm sure she did. And, you know, she was a young woman at the time. You know, when we think back to what we did in our teens and early 20s, you know, it's hard to believe that we pulled those stunts or whatever bad behavior, you know. And she, you know, she was a young woman. She wanted something, and she was going to do anything to get it. And I'm sure as the years went on that she matured and would not be that person that she was when she was young. People had nice things to say about her, her co-workers. They said she was very fair. She was understanding. They enjoyed working with her. And even when she was at West Covina Medical Clinic, I remember when I had, you know, when I went to see Dr. Finch as a patient, I would see her standing in the back writing furiously in her in my record file. And she had a great memory, and she was a very good medical assistant. We ended up losing Dr. Finch as a doctor. His brother-in-law became our family doctor and delivered my third sister, who was the first baby born at the new West Covina Hospital. And I think what happened is that day that Jimmy Papa showed up to confront Finch and Carol, there was such a brouhaha about it that Dr. Gordon at that point, who co-owned the medical clinic and hospital with Finch, realized he had to do something. The hospital hadn't opened yet. They had outstanding loans on it. But they had to do something about Finch, but they couldn't get rid of him. And I think they had a board meeting and decided to remove Finch from his day-to-day practice, but allow him to perform surgeries there where he wouldn't come in contact so much with his female patients. There wouldn't be any affairs because they were afraid what would happen if a spouse came in of some woman he was having an affair with and created a big, you know, big problem. Or what if he performed malpractice while he's in the midst of an affair? He was involved in some malpractice suits. Mm-hmm. And so they could be liable, you know, financially. So they decided to put him in as a surgical, remove him from day-to-day patients. And I think what they did, I don't have proof, I think they likely sent a letter to all of his patients saying Dr. Finch is cutting back seeing patients. He is remaining as a surgeon. You need to find another doctor here at the medical clinic, and offered the names. And I think that's how we ended up with Dr. Gordon. And before, about 8 to 9 months before, he actually killed Barbara. That's sort of the timeline for that. Finch was released in the early 70s from prison. He initially went to Missouri to work as an X-ray technician. He was offered a job there and tried to get his medical license there, but couldn't, even though he took the board exam and passed. He ended up coming back to California, I believe, in around 1984, and managed to get his medical license back in 1984. He moved to Rancho Mirage near Palm Springs, and for the last 11 years of his life, practiced medicine until he died in 1995 from natural causes. And it's interesting to note that all these people, including my parents, are buried in the same cemetery, Oakwood in Glendora, California.
Wow. I want to thank you so much, Steve, for coming on and talking about your book, Satin Pumps, The Moonlit Murders That Mesmerized the Nation. For those people that don't would like to know more about this, this is a Wild Blue Press release. Do you have an Amazon page or somewhere where they might take a look at this book?
Yeah, if they actually go to Amazon and type in Satin Pumps book, it should appear. There are, if they follow me or the book on Twitter, if you go to @SatinPumps on Twitter or facebook.com/SatinPumps, you'll be able to find the pages for the book, and you can get all kind of information. There's a lot of photographs. We have a lot of things that we couldn't put into the book to entertain mm-hmm. you.
Yes, and fantastic photo selection in your book as well. Just wanted to note that. Thank you so much. Satin Pumps, The Moonlit Murders That Mesmerized the Nation. Steve Kosareff, thank you so much. You have a great evening. Thank you so much. Good night.
My pleasure.